Good morning, everybody. I'm going to be looking this way a lot because I don't know. Everybody's sitting over here. People, too. Okay. So like Carrie mentioned, we're kind of about halfway through a series talking about romantic relationships called The One. And it's about this place that all of us have in us that we long for, our missing piece, our other half. Kind of jokingly, as I talked about this funny biblical thing a few weeks ago, our little rib, the one that completes us, all those sort of things, our soulmate, the one that makes us feel completely loved, completely lovable, completely known, all of those things. And the truth is that nobody can be the one for you except for God. That is a huge space in our lives, in our souls, that is longing for God. And sometimes we try to fill that need, fill that void, that hole in our lives with other people and romantic relationships, and nobody can ever be the one for you. Nobody can ever do all of that for you. And you can't be that person for anyone else. And we kind of get into some dysfunctional relationships when we try to make anything that isn't God, God. Anything that is lesser be an ultimate thing. And it begins to mess things up. But when we put God first and we put God as the center of all things, then it reorders our life in a healthy way. It lets things be what they are. We can be in a relationship with somebody that is potentially the two, you know, but that we're never expecting them to be the one. And it just lets them be the person that they are. This is really important no matter how much romance that you think that you have in your life, because it's really all about putting God first. From a very biblical perspective, sometimes in our society we have this hierarchy of married people, and that's the thing with the picket fence and the little dog and all those sort of things. But like in the biblical perspective, especially the New Testament, putting God first is the ultimate, period, full stop. And so singleness is a real significant way of being. Jesus, who is our central person, the one that we aspire to be like, what was his wife's name? Oh, that's right. Yeah, the one that we aspire to be like was single. And so many of the saints that came after that were single because it... is that when you are married, you have other responsibilities, you have other things to give your time and your attention to, but if you are single, then that gives you an opportunity to be fully devoted. So there's that struggle and that ongoing conversation, and it's a first, period, full stop, and then how we live that out and each of our lives is different. So last week, we're kind of going through this progression in relationships. Last week we talked about sex, which was probably pretty interesting for some people. I honestly don't enjoy talking about sex and what we're talking about today, cohabitation and things, because I know that, and a lot of pastors don't talk about this stuff. For good reasons, and the reason is that you're looking out at people's lives, and you know that their stories and some of their stories, and you know, even if you don't know their stories, you know that their lives are shaped and affected by these things, and so that you're churning up pain and hurt sometimes in talking about this stuff. But if we don't talk about that stuff, then there's also not hope. There's also not hope for other people, for our lives to get to. It's an important part of a pastor's job to be teacher. What people called Jesus was rabbi, teacher. The truth will set us free, right? Some ground rules for this. Same stuff as last time. One of your big takeaways that I want you to take away this morning is that you're not special. If you think that I'm talking to you this morning like, oh my gosh, Nathan is like reading my mail, he's talking specifically to me, you're not that special. The things that you do in your life, the way that you navigate your romantic relationships, it's not novel or new or any of that kind of special thing. So I'm not specifically targeting you unless I'm talking to Andrew here. I'm going to talk to him. Just kidding. Let's see. Another place that I want us to avoid is this, this spiritual lie that says, hey, it's too late for me. It's too late for me. In the Christian life, in relationship to God and Jesus, it is never too late. It's never too late to repent. It's never too late to change. It's never too late for God to take a broken, messed up situation and bring something beautiful out of that. Not a single one of us are going to walk through this earth and not create a messed up situation that we need to place into God's hands. It's never too late. So don't hear any of the things that I said last week, or the week before, this week, and be like, well, I guess I'm just damned. Because this is the spot that I'm in. I guess this is the truth for my children. I guess this is the thing. And it's not. Things in God's hands. And you watch what God does with that. The beauty that God brings from that. And maybe, maybe some of us, when it comes to our romantic relationships and sex and cohabitation and marriage and divorce and all these sort of things, maybe we feel like we've already played our cards. We've already done our thing. But I would challenge you to, like, love yourself enough to be open to changing and to find somebody, think of somebody in your life that you love. Maybe it's your child. Maybe it's somebody that you mentor. Maybe it's somebody that you're a friend with that maybe they haven't made those decisions yet. And you could be a good parent and a good mentor to them by providing them with the information and the wisdom and the experience that you've gained. Just because you've gotten some things off track in your life, maybe you didn't even know what the track was, doesn't preclude you from being a good parent and a good mentor. You can say, my sweet, precious little girl, my sweet, precious son, let me tell you, here's some information on this stuff, but also, I didn't do it this way. And let me tell you what's down that road, and I want better for you. I want better for you. When we're looking at our kids, it doesn't mean that we can't tell our kids that stuff. To say, you know, my precious little one, there were certain things that brought you into the world that I might have done differently. And I just wish that I love you. And there's nothing regret about you. I love you. But here's what I wish was different about both of our lives, that you something good that you knew. And this is what I want. I hope that you will navigate things differently. Learn from my experience so you don't have to repeat the same thing. So you can save yourself on the heartache and the loss and the pain. Amen. To not tell your kids that stuff isn't loving and it's not kind. Learn things. Grow in wisdom and pass that on. Your kids will listen to you. Other people will listen to you more than what you recognize, more than what you realize. And they will live up to or down to your expectations. If you're the kind of, or you have this in your plan, at a certain age, I'm going to give my son a big jar of condoms. They're going to use those and say, hey, son, be safe. I would prefer that you not use these or whatever, but like, here you go, because they're going to use every single one of those. If you are the kind of parent that puts your child on birth control, your daughter on birth control as soon as she has her period or somewhere in her early years and says, hey, don't have sex with people that you're not married to, but, you know, just in case you do, they're going to live up to those implied expectations. And guess what? Everybody needs somebody in their life that they could potentially disappoint. Everybody needs somebody in their life that they could potentially disappoint. One of my favorite examples of this is Carrie's grandparents and her raised their kids in the backwoods of Brazil. Five girls. And when I sent these girls off back to the United States to go to college, like, every one of these girls, like, navigated their life really well. And part of the reason for that is that they were afraid that I messed this up. What will Mama think? They weren't afraid that Mama would stop loving them. They weren't afraid that Mama would stop supporting them or that Mama would hurt them, that kind of fear. They had a high regard for Mama. They loved Mama, and they didn't want to break her heart. And they knew that, Mama had high expectations of them, believed in what they could be, believed in, who they were, and they didn't want to ever become less in her eyes. They never wanted to disappoint her. And your kids will live up to or down to your expectations of them. Just something to think about. And it's not wrong to have higher expectations for your kids than what you did for yourself. Change your expectations of yourself and then match them. You know, I expect more of myself now, and I expect the same about you too. It's not hypocritical. All right. Same format that we did last week. I'm going to get into this Christian view on, what it's like to get serious. What's the roadmap like when you are in a relationship, when you're dating and you're wanting to move things forward and getting serious, and then just kind of pull these apart a little bit. So, Tori, go first one. The Christian view on getting serious. What you do here? Lifelong romantic relationships work best when people put God first in their lives. Find a partner who puts God first in their lives, waits to have sex until they're married, makes a lifelong commitment to God and to each other to love and to be faithful to the other person for the rest of their lives. This process supports the best possible outcomes. When relationships are formed this way, God is honored, women and children are protected and provided for, men are matured, society is strengthened, human pleasure is maximized, and human suffering is minimized. Notice I didn't say that it's eliminated. It is absolutely not eliminated, but it's minimized. And you could see that in the statistics that I read last week related to sex stuff and some of the other things I'm going to say today. Jesus told us that in this life you will have trouble. There's no way of avoiding that. You will have trouble. But let's try to be wise about those things and navigate things the way that God says to navigate things. And then maybe the kind of trouble we have will be worthwhile trouble or growing trouble or the kind of trouble that we're not just adding on to life as it is. Here's the secular view on getting serious. It would be crazy to marry someone who you've never lived with, much less had sex with. You would be setting yourself up for misery and failure. You would be making a huge commitment based on a lot of uncertainty. What if you're not sexually compatible? What if you decide that you really don't like each other that much or you're miserable? You don't want to stay in a relationship that doesn't make you happy. And if you really care about someone, you wouldn't want them to be trapped in a relationship that doesn't make them happy either. Moving in together is the best way to avoid the heartache and huge cost of divorce. It doesn't work. If it doesn't work out, then you'll just learn how to learn better and pick someone better the next time. And if it does, then maybe you'll get married and maybe you won't. You'll just stay together for the rest of your lives. Either way, it's the same thing. So here's some. I'm gonna just share with you guys. Take the next few minutes and share some just truth about this stuff. One of the things that is just foundational here is I can share some facts and information, and you could like try to navigate your life by that. I don't think people really make a lot of life decisions that way. I hope that you do. But the real big thing in this is for me and hopefully for you, is who is the God of your life? Who is the God of your life? And so if God says, hey, live and navigate your life this way, then if God is God, and the only way that you have a relationship with God when you are letting God be God, that's the only thing that God can be. God cannot be second, third tier in your life. And if your goal is to have a vibrant relationship with the One, to live a life of godliness and holiness, then the direction's pretty simple in this, and we don't have to talk about it anymore. But that's not how so many of us make our decisions and navigate our life. So we're going to get into some other things. Jesus said that the people that listen to his teachings, follow his teachings, it's like they're building their house on a firm foundation. Storms can come, hurricanes rock the thing, and it's still going to be there. And the people that don't listen to Jesus' teachings are like people that build their house on the sand, that it doesn't matter how beautiful you have built it from the ground up, if it doesn't have a foundation on it. Storms are coming in life, and that when they do, they will destroy the house. I think as far as like these kind of relationships go, another analogy to use would be like commitment. Marriage commitment is the house. It's the foundation. It's the solid walls. It's the roof. And inside, you've got your living spaces. You've got your decorations. You've got your chairs. You've got all the things that give it warmth. The commitment doesn't necessarily give it warmth. I'm sure some of you have known people that were high, maybe your grandparents or something, had a very, very highly committed relationship without warmth inside, right? And so one of the things I think is like, I don't want to have a relationship. So instead of having the commitment, I will make sure that I'll start setting up in a field, and then if it's good, then I'll build a house around it. I'll build the structure around it. So I think it looks like this. Jameson, go to the next slide, sir. Next one, next one, next one, next one. There you go. So you're set. So guess what's going to happen when you set up a house in a field? Storms are going to come, and they're going to destroy the living room, right? It's going to happen because you don't have the structure there. You don't have the roof. You don't have the walls. But if you do have the structure, you do have the roof, you have the walls, you have the commitment there, you can build warmth. And you can maintain that warmth. Bad times are going to come. Hard times are going to come. But you can preserve that thing. But you can't even hold on to what you do have if you don't have that commitment and you don't have that structure. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Your living room, building, setting up house in a field is not a workable plan. But a lot of times people think that that's the wise thing to do. So here's... I'm just going to give you some things to think about. Some of these I'll have references to as I mentioned last week, pretty much anything that I cite data-wise will be either from government institutions or from like left-leaning research centers or universities or something. I want to lean that way on the things that I tell you so you don't think that I'm making stuff up. Cohabitation isn't something that most people decide on. They slide into it. You guys know this, right? So you just kind of wake up one morning, you look across the pillow, and you're like, oh, well, I've spent the last 2 weeks here. I guess we've moved in together. You kind of slide into it, right? So it's not like this is the smarter thing to do because I've made this sort of a decision. It's a pretty natural progression most of the time when you're having sex with people that you're not married to lead into living with them, right? Having sex with people that you date easily slips into cohabitation, and it slips into long-term, uncommitted relationships where the expectations are not defined. Long-term, uncommitted relationships, that's what they are. The ultimate defining the relationship moment is a wedding. That's being very clear. For better, for worse, rich or poor, death, till death do us part, this is what we are doing here. Maybe you've got your own defining the relationship moment or something that you've all spelled out and you've all agreed on or something like that, but it's pretty unlikely. Most of the time people are just guessing. They've slid into something. And for people who are living together and are not married, and for people that are living together and don't want to get married, marriage means something to them, right? It means commitment. It means commitment. I'm not ready to commit. I'm not there yet. I'm not ready to commit. I don't want to commit to you. It means something. And we know why. What is it that people aren't wanting to do? They're not wanting to offer that commitment to each other. Weddings don't... All the other excuses that people have, they just kind of fall away. We marry people on a pretty regular basis here, multiple times a year, and it costs them nothing. Zero. That's one of the things that people say, it's just going to cost so much money, but it doesn't. What it means is commitment. And if you're not married to each other, you're not willing to get married to each other, you don't have a date out there, it's because you're not wanting to commit to each other. You are in a long-term, uncommitted relationship. People view cohabitation as being riskier than marriage, but it's actually more risky than marriage because they are not committed to each other. Cohabitation is an investment without commitment or recognition. So we know that when people stack up divorces, that they're building up more baggage, they're losing more time, they're losing more money, those sort of things. But it also has recognition with it of marriage and divorce. But we know the same thing is also true with people that are in multiple cohabitation relationships, that they are stacking up financial loss, emotional loss, baggage, all this sort of stuff, but there isn't the language to go with it to say what it is that you've lost. And so sometimes people can fool other people or fool themselves in thinking, I haven't stacked up the baggage that I have unless as if I had four different divorces. But it's not true. And it also, like when we lose our person, it's harder for us to communicate that to other people that I lost. Mm-hmm. Saying I lost my boyfriend or my girlfriend in the last 2 years isn't the same thing as like my husband left me, my wife left me, my husband died, my wife died. It's not, we don't have the same language to communicate what that means to us. We're kind of derailing ourselves. This is what the CDC says. A substantial body of evidence indicates that those who live together before marriage are more likely to break up after marriage. So it's not doing the smart thing to make sure that you have a better marriage in the future. You're self-sabotaging yourself. And you're, like, even if your cohabitation does lead to marriage, the chances of it, you're degrading your chances of it being good and healthy, you being happy in that marriage, and it lasting. American Psychological Association, our findings suggest that those who cohabitate before engagement are at greater risk of poor marital outcomes than those who cohabitate only after engagement or at marriage. Men who cohabitate are less likely to marry. They're also less likely to mature. Ladies, if you want, anytime that you want a young man to grow up and mature, do we have a lot of immaturity in our culture?
Yeah.
We do. Anytime you want a young man to mature, the worst thing that you can do for him is offer him sex for nothing. For nothing. It is an age-old thing that cultures would offer men sex in exchange for maturity. You prove that you are self-sacrificing, that you are responsible, that you are a hard worker, that you will do things for the benefit of your community, that you will take risks to provide for and protect and be a good member of the tribe, that you are mature. And then in exchange for that, we will consider you marriage material and let you have a wife, you know? That there's lots of different ways that cultures have worked that out, but that's been the formula forever. So if you take young men, and the main drive in young men is sex. So if you say, hey, you don't have to mature, you don't have to take responsibility for anything, you don't have to grow up in any sort of way, but here you go. You've taken away their main impetus for growing up. One of the things that we know that this costs, this serial cohabitation, is that it costs us time. I think for men that date women throughout their 20s, that they know they want to get married and they know that they want to have children, and then they break up with them at like 28 or something like that, just on the surface value of that thing alone, I think they're real jerks. Because biologically, like, women have a time clock there that's different than men do to fulfill those hopes and dreams. And if you're taking away the parts of their life, you're occupying that space, knowing what their hopes and their dreams are, without being committed to them. And maybe like every relationship's different, but it's a real jerk thing to do. And so you don't have that time stuff. If you spend 2 years with this relationship and 3 years with this relationship and a year here and a year there, then your 20s and your 30s are over, and your life, like a big chunk of your life and potentially hopes and dreams, are broken. negative outcomes. It matters, and there's more people that have cried over that I've known than almost anything else. There's opportunity cost, life energy cost. One of the things people say is that, well, marriages don't last anyway, so what's the point? They actually do. Did you know that the real marriage rate is not 50%? If I asked everybody, said, hey, what's the marriage rate? What's the divorce rate? What's the success in that? Almost everybody would say 50%. And they came out of this thing, as best I can tell, from the 80s, where people projected what the divorce rate was going to be in America in the next 20 years. Well, anybody that knows anything about data and projections and future stuff knows that it's a bunch of hogwash. And that never happened. The lasting till death do us part ratio is about 70%. I think 50% would still be great, but 70% is amazing. They're like, and there's so many other factors in there that you can shift that towards like pretty much a guarantee. How many other things in life can you say, I've made this one decision to commit to this very changing person, committing to me, and it lasting for the whole rest of your life? What lasts for the rest of your life? Toyotas and Hondas, as great as they are, it's not going to last your whole life. That's from the U.S. Census Bureau. This might sound a little sensational, but for the people that I've known that have experienced this, it's not. Cohabitating women are far more likely to experience violence from their person, and even death from their person. Children, who should all be very important to us, they are the safest when they are living with both biological parents. 10 times more in danger of being abused in all sorts of ways if they are living with a single parent and their cohabitating boyfriend, girlfriend. Single moms, you think about that before you bring a man into your house, especially if you've got younger people. That is the most dangerous situation that you can put your little people in that are trusting in you. I mentioned this last time from the CDC, but nearly 20% of women experience pregnancy in the first year of cohabitation. And then what do you do with that? The Journal of Marriage and Family says that one of the most clearly defined correlates of cohabitation is an increase of increased risk of marital disillusion. Psychology Today, forget the professor's name that wrote this article. You can look it up. Cohabitation is increasingly a context for childbearing. Since cohabitating parental unions are relatively unstable, the increasing number of couples who break up in such unions will mean more people entering future relationships with the challenge of children in tow. And so then you're getting into this dating relationship where you've got kids or you're raising your children in a single-parent household. And for those of you who have been raised in a single-parent household or are doing that, you know that it's a massive struggle. You know that the data on that is just devastating, absolutely devastating. And I'm not saying, and I say that with a lot of care and concern, because I know a lot of single moms and things to just, they know the struggle and what they're trying to overcome. And it's a tough job. Psychology Today. Prior research has shown that serial cohabitation is strongly associated with economic disadvantage among unmarried couples, lower odds of marriage, and increased odds of poor marital outcomes. But serial cohabitation is growing rapidly. One of the pushbacks to the thing... Yes?
Immature men do not pay child support.
And immature men don't pay child support. There's a lot of ways to get around that. And you can say, yeah, the law, but like... One of the accusations of this Christian worldview that I'm advocating here is people say, yeah, well, it's unrealistic. People don't wait to get married. It just doesn't happen if that, like that. You're just making a choice for loneliness. The Journal of Marriage and Family says that almost people are virgins when they say they're. Let me say that again. Today, not 1950s, today, almost 1 in 5 people are virgins when they say they're spouse. And you might say, oh my gosh, I don't know anybody like that. I'm going to say, oh my gosh, birds of a feather, they flock together. If you don't know anybody, it's because maybe you're hanging out with the wrong kind of people. And if you're hanging out with the wrong kind of people, then maybe you're not the right kind of people. And if you change the kind of people that you are, and then you begin hanging out with another kind of group of people that you have become that kind of people, then you will probably hang out with that 1 in 5. Those people are typically, often they are Christians and religious people. So if you said, a say what on that, think of birds of a feather, they flock together. Parents, if you want your, if you want to encourage, one of the things I learned from being a youth minister, there will become a time where not that what you say and what you do matter less in your children's lives, but other people begin to also to matter more. You still matter, even though when you live your life, who you are, the way you talk, your advice, your input, your love, your care for them, all that stuff matters, but also peers and things begin mattering also more and more. And one of the best things that you can't pick who they're going to befriend and what their group is going to be, but you can pick the group they're going to have to choose from. That's one of the strongest parental things that you can do in the teenage years, is you can pick the group they have to pick from. Amen. It's a big power. It's a big power. One of the other things is like, how are you going to know if it's the right person? You're not going to marry the right person. I didn't marry the right person. You didn't marry the right married. You're not going to marry the right person. You're not the right person for them. They're not the right person for you. I promise you. There are better and worse. That's all. It's a scale that it's on. There's better and worse. And I hope you got a good one. And I hope you like made a really good exchange on your part. You know, I really took advantage of Carrie on that exchange. I really did. She's amazing. I played the better or worse game a lot better than she did on that. But I got her. We're committed. I love romantic stories as much as the next person, but like the magic feelings of like, hey, love at first sight, blah, 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 blah. We make decisions, right? If you really fall in love with somebody and you think, this is so great, and you find out that they're your stepsister, those feelings are going to like go away. Or you found out they voted for a president that you hate. Those feelings will dissolve, you know, or whatever it is, you know. We make decisions in those things. We are deciding. And you're not going to marry the right person. You have commitment, and you make that you work together, and you make that marriage work, and you make it good, or you suffer together. Which leads into another thing. Putting happiness at such a high regard for yourself and for other people is just stupid. I don't want Carrie to be happy without me. I want her, if it's going to be happy without me or miserable with me, I want her to be miserable with me, and we'll be miserable together. And we'll just keep working at things until we can be happy together. And I promise you, if you are in a lifelong committed relationship with somebody else, you're going to be miserable together sometimes. I mean, one of the most difficult people for me to live with and be around is myself, and I can't get away from me. And probably that's true for you some days. I don't prioritize Carrie's happiness, and she doesn't prioritize mine higher than us being together and being committed to each other. There's a blog that I really like called onechristianlife.com. Sharon says that she's good. Here's some things from that. For those of you who don't know, that's a place where I write things. Married men make more money, perform better at work, and manage their money better than their cohabitating peers. One of the thoughts about cohabitating is like, I just need to work. I need to put this off until I have everything set right. Well, you know what? Marriage is a very focusing thing. And men, especially, once they get married, they focus. and they are motivated because they have someone to provide for, especially if you haven't had sex with them beforehand and they are very committed to like being a good provider and protector for you, they quit paying attention to other things and they start trying to figure out how to advance. Married people, especially men, are healthier in almost every category and live longer than cohabitating people. Men still don't live as long as women by a long shot. Married people have more frequent and more satisfying sex than cohabitating people, so put that one in the happier sex category. Despite popular belief, cohabitation makes it less likely. And these are all cited from CDC and National Institute of Health and universities and various things. Despite popular belief, cohabitation makes it less likely that a couple will get married, more likely that they will get divorced if they do get married, regardless of whether the couple is engaged or has plans to marry when they cohabitate. There's that last bit, I have read this past week some varying things that, like, if you move in together after you are engaged and you have a clear plan to get married, then there's varying statistics on whether that has any effect on outcomes or not. So you're basically having a defining the relationship conversation already before you move in together. So there's some disagreement about that. For happy, unhappy married people, divorce doesn't lead to unhappiness. Staying together and working things out does. Having children before marriage raises the likelihood of divorce. Nearly one in five women experiencing pregnancy will experience pregnancy during the first year of cohabitation. I already said that. Children living with their married parents have a higher life outcomes than those living with cohabitating couples. Children raised with both parents in the home have much better life outcomes than children raised in a step family or single parent. Married people have happier and less susceptible, are less susceptible to addictions, emotional disorders. We accumulate baggage over the years. And again, like I said at the beginning, I'm not wanting to pile on anything onto anybody's life and make stuff seem any harder, but like, can we grow in wisdom, and can we have the courage to learn from our own mistakes, or learn from our own journey, our own path, and love other people, love the young people enough in our life to develop and grow and say, hey, this is what I didn't know all this stuff then. I know all these things now. Nobody taught me these things. Nobody was around for me in these things, but I'm here for you. And I believe you can do better. Please do better than I did. We can learn and we can grow. So wrapping things up here. Here's a roadmap for what this looks like. I've mentored young men for a long time that have been involved in crime and different things. And one of the challenges with them in making good relationship decisions is that they've never seen good relationships in their life. They've never been to a wedding. They've never been around married people. They don't know what that's like. And so that's a real challenge. And so maybe this can be helpful to you. Here's six steps on navigating this stuff. Build your life on the foundation of the one. Get your spiritual and your emotional needs, your sense of meaning and purpose and peace and contentment and stuff from all of those good things from God. First and foremost, get all those things from God. Ground deep in that. Then, if having a romantic relationship with somebody else is still something that you want, then pray about finding your two. And then as you are running after God, look beside you and see who's there. Who else is living a life of loving God and being committed to those things and loving what you love and dreaming what God dreams? Ask yourself, could I live into the dream of God better with this person than I can on my own? It's an important question because God's first. Can I live into the dream of God better with this person than I can on my own? Could I be a better follower of Jesus married to this person than not married to this person? You see how Jesus is central in this? If you think that the answer could be yes and you're interested in them, let them know what you are interested in. hey, I'm interested. I have the one in my life. I'm looking for a two. I think you could be it. I want to spend time with you. I like you, and I want to be in a relationship that leads to marriage. And if you get that out of the way early, you're not raising your crazy flag, you're raising your mature flag. And you save yourself a lot of heartache. And if they are interested, then begin dating them in a godly sort of a way with the question between both of you, is this someone that I should marry? Is this someone I should marry? If not, break up and move on. And if it is, set a date. So here's some things on what to do with all of this for all of us. Make God first. Pursue God. Let God be the one in your life. Don't let sex or relationships or other sorts of things become an idol in your life. A big idol or a little big God or a demigod, any of that sort of stuff. Practice do-overs. This is a big thing in my life. Big thing. Parenting is really, really important to me. It's really important that I not screw up my kids. But guess what? I screw up my kids. I mess it up. I mess it up really bad in different ways. And so we have this. I've got deep ruts in me that I've tried to deal with. And so one of the things that we do is we have do-overs. If there's a situation that I didn't handle very well, I'll get down on my knees and look at my little person and say, hey, you know, 10 minutes ago, yesterday, last week, this has really been bothering me. I didn't do this right. I didn't respond to you in the right way. Daddy did wrong. Can we have a do-over? So you were coming out of the bathroom and this happened, and this happened. They're like, let's redo this, and I want to do this better. We have do-overs, and you can apply that to your life in lots of different ways. Not just in those individual situations, but just saying, hey, I want to do this situation over. I want to do my future relationships different than I did before. You're not stuck in, you're not anchored in your past or anchored in past things. Practice do-overs. Be good spiritual and moral mentors and parents. Teach your children, teach anyone that will listen about the one and about life. Expect great things from them. Stay involved in church. This is preaching to the choir, really, but like one of the best things that single moms can do is stay involved in church. Why? Because one of the things that your kids are going to be missing is male company and healthy family kind of stuff. Stay in church. That is it's called fictive family. It's substitute family. It's a beautiful thing about the church. That we bring all of our messed up stuff together, but we also bring a lot of our good stuff together too. We can be there for each other. If you are cohabitating, four options here. Talk about this stuff. Decide to break up. Move out and start dating in a good way. Or set a date and get married. Talk about this stuff. Either for the love of God or because of, like, you're paying attention to facts. Either one. Break up. Move out and start dating in a good way. Or set a date and get married. If you want to get married after church today, Carrie and I can take care of that for you. No cost. Although if you buy me lunch, I'd say thank you. God loves you. God loves you. I'm sharing all these things with you because I love you, and I want to invest in who you are and invest in your influence in the world to be good and wise influencers and parents and mentors. I want to save you from the heartache that I have had cried out on my shoulders. And God wants that for you too. God's not out to get you. God continually runs after us and says, I have laid before you life and death, blessings and curses. Please, please choose life. Please choose life. Let's pray.